Hughes, who has played two games this season at Kauffman Stadium and just has 10 plate appearances, hit two home runs yesterday. Meanwhile, Bobby Witt Jr., who has played 28 games at Kauffman Stadium, has 120 plate appearances and 108 at-bats. He only has two home runs this season. So Ella De La Cruz, from a power number, has matched a lot of those numbers from Bobby Witt Jr. What does that mean? Does it mean anything? We had Josh Vernier answer this question because I was just curious to hear what Vern had to say about the power numbers from the Royal slugger, Bobby Witt Jr. Here's Vern.
No, I'm not concerned about Bobby's power, sure. Ellie's taken over, certainly, last night's game. But no, I'm not concerned about Bobby's power because he gets so few meaty pitches to hit, especially when Vinny and Salvi behind him have disappointed so much with runners in scoring position. But sure, the bat speed, hard hit rates, yeah, the slug is down for Bobby this season, but also everyone understands that's the guy you can't allow to beat you. And this season, Vinny has not shown the ability to beat you. Salvi hasn't shown the ability to beat you, so why would a team allow Bobby to beat him? Now, with all that said, he's missed a few opportunities, a few of those rare opportunities he has to do damage. You know, the difference right now, Aaron Judge, the thing that he does so shockingly is when he does get that one mistake, he crushes it every time. It's very Barry Bonds-esque from the early part of the century. Bobby right now, no, not capitalizing on every single mistake, but I honestly think it has more to do with the guys hitting behind him than Bobby himself.
So that is what Vern had to say about the power numbers being down for Bobby Witt Jr. If you missed it, Ellie De La Cruz, in just two games and 10 plate appearances at Kauffman Stadium, has matched the home run total this year at Kauffman Stadium from Bobby Witt Jr. in 28 games and 120 plate appearances. There is no question that the offensive numbers are down for Bobby Witt across the board. And what does that mean? I would tend to side with Vern in this conversation. I think a lot of the offensive problems right now about the Royals are due to the surrounding and supporting cast. That if you are another pitching staff, why would I let Bobby Witt Jr. beat us? Why would I give Bobby Witt Jr. opportunities to drive in runs? Why would I give him something meaty? Why would I give him a favorable pitch to hit where if we can just simply get through this at bat with Bobby Witt Jr., coming up, Salvi hasn't been the player that he's been in years past. Vinny Pasquantino hasn't bounced back to where he was last June or July pre the wrist injury. So I do think that a lot of the offensive troubles for Bobby Witt Jr. are directly tied into he's the only guy in that lineup that you need to worry about. Maybe you want to throw Mikel Garcia in there, but I think we understand the difference in Bobby Witt Jr., who finished second in the MVP voting, and Mikel Garcia. There's just not a lot of protection around him. There's not a lot of guys before him that get on base. This offense just isn't performing at a high enough level that I think it's allowing teams and managers to sort of pick their spots. And why would you ever give Bobby Witt Jr. a chance to beat you? Because you were going to ask the other Royals offensive players to try to do that. And at least so far this season, those guys haven't been capable of doing that. Rob, where do you stand on this with the power numbers for Bobby Witt Jr. being a little bit down in relation to where they were a season ago?
So yesterday I asked the question about, you know, if it's one thing or the other thing, and you said it's a combination of both. Is that the logic behind what's happening with Caglione? I said, is it, you know, backup quarterback theory or is it his greatness? You told me it's both. I think what we're talking about today with Bobby Witt is the same. I do think you and Vern are correct. I think he's pressing because he knows he's the only guy in this offense. And I think pitchers know if there's a guy to not throw a strike to in the Royals lineup, it's him. It's don't make a mistake. It's nibble. It's throw four outside the zone. And if he gets himself out, party on Wayne. But even on first base, he's a threat. But at first, he's not as big of a threat as putting the ball over the wall. I think you and Vern are correct. But I also think the underlying power numbers are down this year. I know he's leading baseball in doubles, but part of him leading the baseball in doubles is he can turn a single into a double. It's not the ball. It's just bouncing off the wall, and he's putting it deep every single time. There feels to be a dip in power. So it's concerning that a guy last year who at one point we thought could be a 30-30 type of guy is not looking like that at all this season, at least not with his power. But I do think it's fair to say it's impossible for him to flash the power because you, me, Vern, the text line, everyone who plays the Royals, most people playing on the Royals know, why would I throw number seven a strike? A strike to number seven can hurt me. I can give him four junk balls, and I'm good for another nine AB. So I think it's both. The underlying concern is his power, but it's hard for him to flex he has it when he never gets an opportunity.
Looking at his numbers, if you want to extrapolate it out for 162 games, right now Bobby Witt Jr. is on pace to have around 60 doubles. He is on pace to have 14 home runs, 81 RBIs this year. He is on pace to steal around 60 bases this year. His strikeout numbers would be up from where they were a season ago. If you extrapolate what he's done so far, he will strike out 127 times. Last year, he struck out 106 times, so strikeouts are up a little bit. Batting average is noticeably down this year in relation to last year on base percentage, slugging percentage. Most of those offensive numbers are down from where they were a season ago. I do think it's very important to note in this conversation. I do think that at some point this season, Bobby Witt Jr. is going to get hot and get going. Bobby hit 20 home runs as a rookie. Bobby hit 30 home runs his second season, 32 home runs last year. I don't think that this season you're getting 14 homers from Bobby Witt Jr. We talked about this in relation to Salvador Perez and also Vinny Pasquantino. One of the problems for the Royals is just their biggest offensive contributor. He's down 20% last year offensively from what you got. If you can get Bobby hot, where he goes on a 3-4 week stretch, kind of like he did last year after the All-Star game, where you could not get him out really in any capacity last year, that could really help jumpstart this offense and get this thing going. I'm not here telling you that their offense is struggling because of Bobby Witt Jr., and trust me, they have far other problems and issues than Bobby Witt Jr., but your star player being down 15-20%, your second best offensive player, whether you want to say that Salvi or Vinny Pasquantino, you take 50% off of their production last year. You then don't get a whole lot from the outfield. I mean, there's a lot of potholes right now if you're looking at this Royals offense and why the Royals continue to be a bottom five offense in Major League Baseball. Coming up in about 30 minutes, we're going to head to Omaha to check in on Jack Caglione's first start in Omaha. Coming up on the other side, right now the top story in sports is the college football playoff as they try to figure out what expansion will look like. We'll talk about it. Keep it right here. It's The Drive.
The Drive with Carrington Harrison. Watch the show on YouTube by subscribing to the 965 YouTube channel. The Drive brought to you by DM Injury Law. Have you or a loved one been in a car wreck? Contact DM Injury Law today and get the money you deserve. Car wreck? Remember, Mike's got this. 965, The Fan.
Let's switch gears for just a little bit and let's talk about some of the potential changes that are coming to college football. So, you guys know that recently they went to a 12-team playoff model. We've had one season of the 12-team playoff model. We are going to have one more season of the 12-team playoff model, and then we are going to see expansion. Now, we don't know if they're going to go to 14 teams or if they're going to go to 16 teams. Something tells me that if they go to 14, they will have 14 for a very short period of time, and then they will find a reason to add two more teams to get to the 16. So why not just do the heavy lifting right now? Let's just skip the 14 model, and let's go right to 16 if that's where this is going to go by the end of the decade. So they are trying to figure out the right way to do this. There are a couple of different ideas that have been proposed. The Big Ten and the SEC, they want to have a guaranteed model that would guarantee them four spots in the college football playoff. That means they would get a bigger slice of the pie out of the 16. This obviously doesn't make the SEC or the ACC happy. This also doesn't make the Big 12 happy. Wait, why do you guys get more spots? Why do you guys get more revenue? That is only going to widen the gap and the divide between those two conferences and everybody else. There's also infighting between the Big Ten and the SEC. The SEC plays 8 conference games. The Big Ten plays 9 conference games. Wait, we don't get to schedule a patsy in this. we're playing another major Power 5 school while you guys aren't forced to do that. We want you guys to play 9 conference games the way that we play 9 conference games. The SEC is saying, well, we'll do that, but we want certain guarantees and certain provisions to make sure that we get a set amount of teams in the playoffs. Right now, it is all angling on all sides. Everybody is looking out for self. Everybody is trying to ensure that they get themselves the biggest piece of the pie. So, the most recent proposal that has been discussed, that I honestly think is the most fair way to do it, there is a model that would ensure if you win your conference, you would make the college football playoff. So it would be a 5+11 model. So if you win the Big Ten, you're automatically in. If you win the SEC, if you win the ACC, the Big 12, if you win the Power 5 spot. So last year, Boise State was that team. One year, it could be UNLV. It could be Liberty. You guys get the point. So those 5 teams would guaranteed make the tournament. And then the rest of the 11 would be decided by a committee, kind of like what we do in college basketball. In college basketball, if you win your conference tournament, you are guaranteed a spot in the NCAA tournament, and then we have a committee to help determine the seeding and the other teams that make it. That is a idea that is being proposed by college football. That, to me, seems the most fair idea to do it, but you already know there's some complaining about it. Now, Brian Kelly actually had a pretty good idea of how he thinks SEC teams should build their schedule. They want to reach an agreement with the Big Ten, and this is how they would like to do every team in the SEC's schedule. This also, I imagine, would be the same schedule for the teams in the Big Ten. You would play 9 games in your conference. You would be mandatory to play 1 team that is in the Big Ten, and then you can play 2 other games. Now, what do those 2 other games look like? Is that Missouri, for example, playing KU or K-State? Or is this Missouri now trying to schedule Buffalo and Boston College to get 2 guaranteed wins to try to ensure that they can always make a bowl game? Now, we'll see what that looks like. But if you were telling me that this is going to be the uniform model that we have going forward in college football, I welcome that. I don't have a problem with major schools playing one of those kind of gimme games. I understand the economics of college sports. Now, you guys know my idea. I'd be perfectly fine if they move that to the spring and replace the spring game with that. Instead of watching Ohio State scrimmage each other, why doesn't Ohio State play a D2 school around the area? You bring people in. You get to simulate the same thing that you assimilate during the college or during the spring period, and then you sell tickets to it. People would pay to go to that game. Trust me. You already got people paying to watch Kansas go up against SEMO in a football game. If they're willing to do that in August, why would they not do that in March or April? And then once we get to the actual summer, once we get to August, then we start to play real games. So you can play 1 team from another power conference there if you want to keep your rivals. If you want to keep South Carolina and Clemson, you can play that game if you want. If you want Texas to play SMU, you can have that option to do that. And then sure, if you want to play 1 group of 5 school, we don't have any problem with you doing that. But I am all for uniformity and figuring out a way to get the college schedules to match each other. So if you were saying that Alabama and Ohio State are basically going to have the same format for how they build their schedule, sign me up for it. We're going to play 9 games in our league. We're going to guaranteed play 1 team from the SEC, and then we have control over the other 2 games that we play, and we got to play a real school. I'm not talking about that Ohio State plays Akron and then plays Tennessee Tech to just get a guaranteed 2-0. No, I'm talking about scheduling real actual opponents to try to build the best resume possible for inclusion in the college football playoff. I actually don't have any problem if that's how they want to do it, but something tells me that is not how all of them want to do it.
Carrington, you're on the internet the same way I'm on the internet. Have you seen that meme where it's like the world's worst person actually makes a good point? That's how I feel about Brian Kelly right now, having a good idea for the future of college football scheduling. The SEC, first and foremost, needs to join the revolution and play 9 conference games. Once we get over that hurdle, which has surprisingly been a big hurdle, but once we get over that hurdle, you know what we would have? 4 major conferences, and you know we could build a scheduling matrix. Do you know why the NFL works? They have a scheduling matrix. Hey, last year, the AFC West teams, they all took on the AFC North teams. Or, well, guess what? Now we rotate. They all this year take on the AFC South, and then it works that way. If every team were playing nine league games, you could set it where nine league games and then one of your non-cons come from the scheduling matrix. That means one year, the Big 12, you get the SEC. One year, you get the ACC. One year, you get the Big 10. We have to figure out the nitty gritty of how to, you know, figure out if it's the 12th best ACC team against the 15th best Big SEC team. But we could figure that out. And then it's two games where you pick who you want to put on your schedule. If you're Missouri and you want to play Kansas for a rivalry game and a big crowd and all those things, go crazy. If you want to put SEMO on the schedule, that's your prerogative. But I think Brian Kelly is so close to having this so right, which is just gross. I'm not a Brian Kelly fan. But if you go to nine conference games, you can start a scheduling, you know, build for all four conferences.
Let me ask you this. No, I'm with you, but let me ask you this. In what world then should UNLV and Boise State be included in the college football playoff if that's the structure that we're talking about? Because if you are telling me, and I don't disagree with you, if you were telling me Ohio State, for example, let's use them, the defending champions, they're going to play nine Big Ten teams. They're then going to play one team in the SEC. Let's pick a team by random. They play Tennessee. They're then going to play two other games. I'm guessing they're not scheduling Boise State for one of their non-conference games. How does Boise State ever build a resume where you and I can argue that they should be included in this college football playoff? Because in that world, I don't know what reason you have to schedule Boise State. If you were telling me that we're going to play 10 games against teams from the SEC or the Big Ten in my free time, you know who I'm not scheduling in August or September? I'm not scheduling Boise State because there is no advantage for us to play Boise State. So if we are talking about a world that is going to guarantee that one of these other teams have a spot at the table, you got to tell me why Boise State gets a spot at the table where who's Boise State's schedule going to be in comparison? And how could you make an argument that Boise State, as a team that won the Mountain West, that they are as good as the fourth best team in the SEC? I've seen that team regularly scheduled on a game-in, game-out basis. While I saw Boise State play Colorado State, UNLV, and UTEP for the last 3 months or so, that's where I think those group of five schools are going to be tough. Because essentially, you have now been boxed out of the schedule matrix. There's not a lot of room for you to go play anybody in that world if now 90% of your schedule is going to be you playing either teams in your own league or now playing one team from the SEC.
I think you're right. The Boise States get screwed in that world. If you're Boise State, you got to, A, find a team at the bottom of one of the, or the mid-tier one of those power leagues, because you're right. If Ohio State, and we won't even use the SEC, if Ohio State played nine league games and then the scheduling matrix shifted and they got the ACC, which meant they got to play NC State, a fine whatever school, and they had two other non-con games, they're not picking up Boise State. But if you're Boise State and you look at the schedule, you go, oh, in 2027, the Big 12 is playing the ACC, which means those SEC schools are probably not going to schedule those type of teams. Now a Kansas State probably becomes available. Now an Arizona becomes available. And a team that is a mid-tier Power 5 team pops up on your schedule, and then you got to fill your schedule with the other best group of fives. You got to have Marshall. You got to have Northern Illinois. You got to have UNLV. You got to, you know, go out and find Memphis when they were good that 1 year. You got to have a schedule that just screams, we beat all the group of five teams, and that's how you get included. I also would say, to answer your question with a question, do we think the future of college football is based around what the group of five wants to do? Because it feels like every idea we've seen is screw the group of five in some form or fashion.
No, you're 100% right. But I think in this, and I think you and I are on the same page more than anything, is they're giving them one seat for now. If you were telling me that the SEC and the Big Ten are now going to reach a schedule agreement, if the SEC adds another conference game, they are doing so to benefit themselves. If they're going to reach a scheduling agreement with the Big Ten, they are doing it to benefit themselves. You know what hurts the SEC and the Big Ten? that we got to guarantee that Boise State every single year gets a spot, because Boise State is then taking away a spot from an Ole Miss. It's then taking away a spot from an Indiana or a Michigan State. Wait, we're doing all of this and we still got to give up a little bit of real estate and a little bit of room to this team that doesn't nearly play the same schedule that we do? I just think that's something that we need to keep in mind when talking about how we're going to build this playoff and what the future of the sport looks like. There was also a very interesting quote that came out from the SEC where they said, and I quote, "They believe that college football is more about the number of losses that you have than who you play." I'm sitting there thinking, what college? Have you guys not been paying attention? That's always how it is. That's how I've been arguing for the beginning. I think how we have envisioned college football is flawed. Losing in the NFL does not matter. Teams lose in the National Football League. You're going to win the Super Bowl and lose five times over the course of the year. Now, that's still enough for you to get to the playoffs. You can still win your division. You can still host playoff games. Losing in the National Football League is not the end-all be-all. Now, if college football wants to create a model like that, but I think you're going to have to do some reprogramming. Everything about college football since the inception of the sport has been more about the loss column than the win column. If you got a one, heaven forbid you get a two, it doesn't matter who you beat. It doesn't matter how many wins you have, because the losses supersede everything. And that is a major reason why you have seen teams duck competition, duck the smoke, don't want to play meaningful games, because in a lot of times the juice ain't worth the squeeze. The negative, the penalty for it doesn't really justify the reward of who you actually beat. You can go 10-2 and be better than a 12-0 team, but people are going to say, oh, well, you lost two games. So that's why I think in a lot of ways, you just have to make it where, well, everybody plays somebody. There is no manipulating your schedule. There is no, for the first month of the college football season, you played Little Sisters of the Poor and Lamar, so you were able to start off 5-0, while this other team, they started the year 3-2. Well, yeah, they went on the road and lost to Oregon. Yeah, they went on the road and they lost on the road to Tennessee. Those are not losses that you should hang your head about. I do think there needs to be some reprogramming in how we kind of evaluate college football teams and what is acceptable, and that losing doesn't have to be the end-all be-all and completely damage and wreck your season the way that it has for seemingly every college football year up until last year. Last year was really the first season where losing wasn't that much of a penalty in college football. It's been like that since the beginning, though.
I don't want to detract from your point, which I think is a very good one, but the fact that I know I saw that quote linger around came from the Alabama athletic director. Stop it. You can miss me with that. Tell me about how, oh, we live in a society now where quality games doesn't matter as much as losing. 2 years ago, Florida State went undefeated and won a power league. They went 13-0. Florida State, they were undefeated. You know what they didn't get into? The 14 playoff. You know who did? Alabama. You know Alabama had that year that Florida State didn't? A loss. So maybe it's just revisionist history. Maybe he has the most, you know, a really bad short, you know, short memory loss. I don't know. But the fact that 24 months ago, Alabama's AD was getting the benefit of being a lost team versus an undefeated team, now he's getting screwed on the back end by it. I'm sorry. You cannot be the messenger for that opinion. You just can't be.
Yeah, to give you guys the quote, Greg Sankey said, quote, "In the new college football playoff format, it's clear that not losing is more important than playing quality opponents," which I would happen to agree. I kind of think that's kind of always been the case in college football. I don't think that's a current college football thing. I think that being undefeated, as crazy as it sounds, I think that being undefeated is overvalued in college football, which leads you to schedule nobody because your loss column is the most important stat, where a team can have two losses, be better than the undefeated team because they've challenged themselves and played in difficult road games, where a team can be undefeated and they just got the right schedule mix. Last year, there were three lost teams that would have beat Indiana, but Indiana just got the right schedule in the right year. A team like that is going to pop up every single year in college football. you got an 8-win or a 9-win team, but you get the right schedule, you get the right breaks, and all of a sudden your 9 or 8 wins turn into 11 or 12 wins. You look up and then you're in the college football playoff. I think that's going to happen more times than not. Let's keep the football conversation going. Here is Terry Bradshaw. Terry Bradshaw, he hates the idea of Aaron Rodgers playing for the Pittsburgh Steelers.
What do you think about possibly Aaron Rodgers being the quarterback?
That's a joke. He shouldn't. That is just to me is a joke.
What are you going to bring him in for 1 year? Are you kidding me?
I mean, that's not the Steelers' way, right?
No, man. That guy needs to stay in California and go,
thank
go
you.
Somewhere and,
thank
and
you.
Chew on bark and whisper to the gods out there.
100%. These guys on the show, Mr. Bradshaw, yeah. know I'm not a fan of his. We've been around each other personally, and he was not a kind person.
He does not. I had to go over and introduce myself to him. He's not. I had to go, hey, Aaron, I'm Terry Bradshaw. I know he knows me, but I just felt like I better tell him who I am.
Yeah.
And not, you know, you walk in there and you get in his presence and you feel like it's going to start snowing. So.
That was Terry Bradshaw talking about Aaron Rodgers. And as you could hear, he is not too excited about the idea. I'm going to tell you something that you probably already know, but it's still worth mentioning nonetheless. The three most honest people are kids, drunk people, and old people.
Terry Bradshaw might be two of them in that clip.
They don't know how to tell a lie. You ask a six-year-old a question, they're going to tell you the truth. They don't have lying in them yet. Not about that kind of stuff. Sure, they might lie about, did you eat ice cream earlier? Or, did you break this thing? They might lie to you then. They ain't lying to you about what they seen. They ain't lying to you about what they heard. Kids are honest. What's the saying about drunk people? A drunk mind says sober thoughts. Drunk people, they gonna tell you the truth. It's truth serum. Old people, they gonna tell you the truth. They didn't live long enough. They don't care about the repercussions. They're going to tell you the truth. I think that Terry Bradshaw is voicing how a lot of people feel in Pittsburgh about Aaron Rodgers. That is a proud organization. It's a proud franchise. Aaron Rodgers coming in here and thinking that he can do things his way and not adhere to what we are in Pittsburgh, that doesn't fly here. Terry Bradshaw is Mr. Pittsburgh Steeler. If you had a Mount Rushmore, his face is on it. He might be the most popular, the most famous. He certainly is in the shortlist conversation. He is that organization. The fact that Terry Bradshaw is not wrapping his arms around Aaron Rodgers in support should really tell you something. He doesn't see this as a torch pass thing. And I think a lot of that is just on how Aaron has kind of handled this offseason. I think we all know at some point it's going to come across our desk that Aaron Rodgers is the newest member of the Pittsburgh Steelers. We've been sitting here and waiting on that now for 2 months that news was going to come across. We still don't have it. They're starting OTAs and there's still no clue of when Aaron Rodgers is going to be back. Now, maybe Aaron eventually just decides I'm not going to play. What I actually think has happened is I think there's some kind of handshake agreement. And I think once we're done with all of this mandatory stuff, closer to the middle and end of July, I think that Aaron is then going to make the announcement that he's going to play for the Steelers, that they have sort of excused him from all of this. I think when he went on Pat McAfee a couple of weeks ago, he was basically telling us that. Now, I don't know what's going on in Aaron's personal life. I know we like to laugh and joke about the darkness retreat. He said he was going through something. I'm inclined to believe him. Maybe it's family issues. Maybe it's personal issues. I don't know what's going on with Aaron Rodgers. But maybe Aaron has just communicated to the Pittsburgh Steelers, hey, I'm committed to playing for you guys. I'm keeping my body in check. In July, let's follow up with each other, and I'll be ready to come play quarterback for you guys. I think they've reached some kind of agreement like that. But I also understand if you're Terry Bradshaw, if you're somebody looking at it through the Pittsburgh Steelers, this time matters. We're not talking about a guy who has been in this offense, been in this organization now for 13 years, and is taking the offseason to reflect. We're talking about somebody who is now joining his third separate team in 4 years. New playbook, new teammates, new city, new everything. And you think you can just show up at 40 years old in late July and play at a really high level? I mean, that seems like a really, really difficult thing to do. But it sounds like Aaron's going to try to do that. I do think Aaron's going to play this season with the Pittsburgh Steelers. I think everybody kind of thinks that, but at some point you kind of got to show up and be the quarterback of the Pittsburgh Steelers. And at least so far, he has just made the decision that he is not going to be there for this portion of the NFL calendar. Coming up on the other side, we're going to head to Omaha, Nebraska. Jack Caglione played his first game at home for the Storm Chasers. We'll find out how it went. Keep it right here. It's The Drive.
The Drive with Carrington Harrison on your home for Kansas City sports. 96.5 The Fan. Brought to you by DM Injury Law. Have you or a loved one been in a car wreck? Contact DM Injury Law today and get the money you deserve. Car wreck? Remember, Mike's got this.
You know something is going really well if we have a guest on back-to-back days. Let's head to the phone lines right now to be joined by Connor Happer. He is with 620 in Omaha. Yesterday, Jack Caglione had his AAA debut in Omaha for the Storm Chasers. Connor, how you doing today, my man?
I'm good, Carrington. Good to talk to you again. What's up?
Absolutely, man. Long time no talk, man. I know you probably got, I don't know, you're probably headed to job number six right now.
That's right. Yeah, we're on job three out of six, I think, at the moment. Going down to Arkansas for a regional this weekend. I saw that you're having the Kansas coach on after me, so this will be – you guys are like the biggest Kansas City radio station on the Arkansas Fayetteville regional.
Okay, yeah, no, we actually – we do have him coming on in just a little bit. Rob, my producer, you spoke to him. He is a Kansas alum, so, you know, we try to show love from time to time to KU. Let's actually start with that, and then we'll talk about Jack Caglione in a bit. How are people feeling about this regional down in Arkansas? How are people handicapping this regional?
Yeah, I think, you know, Arkansas probably seems like the heavy favorite. The thing about them, though, is this: they've struggled in the postseason. They haven't got out of a regional in a couple of years. They have an upset on their home field. So, you know, I think it's one of those things where anything could happen. KU with the long ball, you know, Creighton with its pitching and its, you know, hot hitting at the moment. I think as well, like both of those teams will pose interesting challenges. We've actually seen, Creighton has seen North Dakota State, the fourth team in this regional this year, and we've actually lost to them once out of twice this year as well. So I think it's top to bottom pretty good. Arkansas will have their hands full, but you know they get the crowd going and all those things. Like I would think that they're a pretty heavy favorite to get out of it.
One of my really good friends actually lives in Fayetteville. It's one of the few, I would say, towns in America that really loves college baseball. You know, there's a lot of places that love college football, a lot of places that love college basketball. Fayetteville is one of those places, like, really get into their college baseball team.
No, it's really cool. Like, you go there, you know, most college towns, you go there and it's like a college football team plays there, and then, you know, they show up and they think a football game's playing, but it's actually a baseball game. Like Ole Miss, I would describe as that. Like, they came up for the College World Series a couple of years ago and you know, played the national championship game and won the national championship. And talking to their fans, they were like, yeah, we just like football. And they told me there was a party up here, so we came. Arkansas is like the exact opposite. They're locked in on Hogs baseball. Like, it's actually really, really cool. So they do it big down there.
Right now, we're talking to Connor Happer. He is with 1620 down in Omaha. He is going down to Fayetteville for the regional. KU is in that regional. Also was yesterday at the AAA debut, at least at home, for Jack Caglione in Omaha. So, Connor, you got a chance to see Cags up close. You got a chance to see him in person. What was your impression?
Yeah, man. I mean, he's first of all, he's a giant. I mean, you guys know this. I mean, they were – I was having some conversations with people yesterday – like, they're about what number he's – I mean, he wants to be 14, and he had it 41 on the road, you know, because the jersey numbers are congruent, run congruent with the sizes of the uniforms. He got into a 14 in the light blue jerseys that they were wearing yesterday, but it was a little snug on him. So that probably – he's impressive. You know, the way he moves is really, really – really smooth, and he didn't look totally comfortable at the plate yesterday, but he's the type of guy that could turn it on in a flash, and I mean, he's already done it for a week in AAA. People will adjust, but he'll adjust with them. Like, I don't think he'll have any problem with AAA pitching over a long period of time.
You mentioned the adjustment. What is the biggest challenge you see from players that were in AA that are getting the call up to AAA? What is the part that they struggle with the most?
I think, you know, one of the things is just handling the next level. Like these are adults now. These aren't like prospects anymore. And a lot of these guys have been in the major leagues or are in the major leagues, right? So you kind of have to deal with that entire thing. It's a level up, but we've seen over the last several years, I think, in my opinion, just like a flattening a little bit. There, it feels like minor league baseball is generally just younger now. So it's maybe less of an adjustment as it was before. I think you see guys moving up quicker on a quicker path to the major leagues nowadays. So maybe, I mean, that learning curve hasn't been too difficult so far for Jack. But man, he's got some raw power, and it's just, you know, you're looking for the holes. And then, you know, you match it up with what's going on in Kansas City as well. And there's a need there, right? So, like I said yesterday, you got to think the clock's ticking a little bit.
You mentioned yesterday that Omaha, there was a little bit of a buzz around him. It was day one. It was his home debut. I saw a lot of local entities here in Kansas City made the drive up to see him for his first start. What was the reception like? What was the crowd like to see him make his debut in Omaha?
It was great, man. It was a good pop. You know, people were excited. There was a little girl like right in the front row behind the Storm Chasers dugout that set a big sign that said Jack. Like, I think people are as excited as they've been for a prospect to come through here in a while, just because of, you know, the type of player that he is and like what he brings to a baseball team, right? It's the power. It's the, like, people want to see that. They want to come into the ballpark and they want to see him hit 450-foot home runs. Like, even if he goes 0 for 5 one night, there's just as good of a chance the next night, tonight, he's going to come back and hit one into the cornfield out beyond right field. So, like, I think that's absolutely why people are going to continue to show up this week. It wasn't great weather last night. I think it's going to get better throughout the week. So I would expect people to continue to come out all week to see Jack the first time in Omaha.
Right now, we're talking to Connor Happer for a couple more minutes, just getting his thoughts on AAA. Jack Caglione made his Omaha debut yesterday, played his first game in Omaha. Connor, when you watch this Omaha team, are you seeing anybody else that you think is potentially close? I do kind of want to get your opinion on John Ray. We haven't got a chance to see him for a whole lot of time here in Kansas City. Only played two games for the Royals, but certainly someone you're familiar with in Omaha. I guess two-part question. Tell us a little bit more about John Ray. And is there anybody else in Omaha that you think is close to coming up to Kansas City?
Yeah, I love watching Rave. I mean, I think he's a exciting player. You know, he can kind of do everything pretty well. The question is he going to be able to produce, you know, enough to be able to stick up there, right? Like, so we'll see how that kind of works out for him. You kind of just have to get hot over a short period of time. But I like Rave. I think if there's a guy to watch out for, and, you know, the Royals, it doesn't seem like they need a whole lot of infield help. Like, they have the options kind of there, although there's a couple guys who aren't hitting at the moment. But, you know, Cam Devaney is a really good infielder. He's a surprisingly good athlete. You know, can really pick it defensively up in the middle infield. So I think you could put him at either of those spots, and he's really solid. Decent with the bat as well. Hits it for a little bit more power probably than you would expect out of a second baseman shortstop type. So yeah, I mean, part of that is the ballpark too. Like, they play in a pretty small ballpark, and across the minor league, you know, the league that they play in, there are some small ones. But like, I would highlight him. And you know, it seems like MJ is starting to, you know, get a little bit more comfortable. It's been a long time coming for him to kind of get it turned around, but it feels like he's really starting to maybe get onto something as of the last week or so.
Connor, you have to come on the show one more time to be friend of the show. So this is like a pre-screening interview for us to determine if you're going to come on the show one more time. Whenever you go get a hot dog, what condiments do you put on it?
Anything but ketchup.
You know what? I'm going to go ahead and fast track your application. We have new friend of the show, Connor Happer.
Let's go.
Joining us on the show. Connor, you know what? Usually we make people come on three times to be friend of the show, but with that answer, you know what? I got the power to fast track, and I can move you to the front of the line. Thanks a lot for coming on today.
Love it, man. Call me anytime. We'll talk to you later.
Absolutely. That is Connor Happer joining us on the show today. That's the kind of friends that we need on this show. That's the kind of people that we want in our corner. Anything but ketchup. I don't need to hear anything else. I have more questions to ask him. I don't need to ask anything else. I don't need anything else. The only person that will accept on this show that eats ketchup is Patrick Mahomes. If you're not Patrick Mahomes and you like ketchup, I don't know if there's a place for you here. I don't know if this is a home for you. If you're Pat, I'm willing to make an exception for obvious reasons. I am making that exception for Matt Verderam. I am making that exception for Connor Happer. No, you either get in line or you're not with this family. That's the right answer. Salute to him. I was very optimistic to hear that things are turning around for MJ Melendez. Man, good. It would be in everybody's best interest if MJ Melendez got back to normal. Just a reset. This is why you go down to Omaha. Go down there, clear your head, hit well for 6-7 weeks, come back up sometime in July, sometime around the All-Star break with a new look on life. An injury happens, you feel comfortable, you're ready to come back up to the major leagues. I'm not ready to completely turn the page on MJ Melendez. I know things were a little shaky there for a little bit, but I'm not ready to completely give up. I'm not ready to completely give up on MJ Melendez. So it certainly is good to hear that he is turning things around. All right, coming up at the top of the hour, you know what? Let's talk a little bit of NFL. We are 99 days away from the... Actually, no, my apologies. We have the manager at KU. My bad, Rob. I forgot to write that down. At 3 o'clock, we are going to have the manager for the Kansas Jayhawks. Pat Fitzgerald's going to join us on the show, and we'll get you ready for their weekend in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Keep it right here, so drive.